Hi there. I'm so excited to welcome you to the Arthritis Life podcast, where we share arthritis life stories and tips for thriving with autoimmune arthritis. My name is Cheryl Crow, and I am passionate about helping people navigate real life with arthritis beyond joint pain. I've been living with rheumatoid arthritis for 20 years, and I'm also a mom, occupational therapist, video creator, support group leader, and I created the Room to Thrive self-management program. I am so excited to help you live a more empowered life with arthritis. We're going to cover everything from kitchen life hacks to navigating the healthcare system to coping with friends who just don't get it. Seriously, no topic is going to be off limits on this podcast. My interviewees and I share our honest stories of how chronic illness affects our lives. This includes discussions about mental health, sex, shame, pregnancy, body image, advocacy, self-acceptance, and so much more. You'll hear stories from all ends of the spectrum, from a person who's living in Medicaid remission from psoriatic arthritis to somebody living with severe mobility restrictions and severe pain from rheumatoid arthritis. You'll hear how people manage their conditions in different ways, like medications, mindfulness, movement, social support, work accommodations, and so much more. You'll also hear from rheumatology experts who just get it. We'll dive deep into the science behind chronic pain and what's the latest evidence for lifestyle changes that can help you thrive with arthritis, including exercise, sleep, nutrition, stress reduction, and more. This is your chance to sit down and chat with a friend who's been there. Ready to figure out how to manage your arthritis life? Let's get started. Okay, I am so excited today to have a fellow multi-passionate person. I mean, a lot of people we've had in the podcast are multi-passionate, but we have someone that I really look up to in the rheumatology community, Christine Stamatos. She is going to tell us a little bit about herself, but she is somebody who's done a lot of amazing work in the Association of Rheumatology Professionals, which is like the sister org to the American College of Rheumatology. So why don't you give us a quick introduction to you and your work, and what is your relationship to arthritis?
So that's a great question. So I'm a nurse practitioner by trade. I worked as a critical care nurse for 20 years and then went back to get my NP certification. And then while I was in school, I met someone who was a rheumatologist, and I thought I was just going to go and do a little bit of time with the rheumatologist. I spent one day and knew that was what I was going to do the rest of my life. He was amazing. So I then switched over when I graduated and went into rheumatology. I worked in rheumatology for many years under some amazing rheumatologists who taught me so much. And some of my mantras, you asked me if I had mantras, some of my mantras come directly from those people. I then was working in a practice with, I think there were four other providers, so four physicians. I think there was one physician assistant. And in all of, so this was the third practice I was in. And in every practice I went to, I always ended up with the patients who had a lot of questions, who started crying in the visit, who had issues with compliance. Everyone would say, you know, I think you should follow up with Christine. So they would end up on my schedule. And I think that has to do with the fact that I'm a nurse practitioner and we look at patients from a more holistic and biopsychosocial approach. So anyway, I started seeing patients that had really just severe pain, and they'd been to multiple pain providers, neurologists, orthopedists, surgeons, and they were stuck. Nobody had any answers for them. And so it drove me actually to go back to graduate school, and I went back and got a doctorate. And my focus on my doctoral work was on non-pharmacologic strategies for chronic pain. So now my practice is taking all of those years of experience in rheumatology and then specifically with pain and applying them to people who live with rheumatic disease, which, as you may or may not know, is something that many people live with. So when it comes to arthritis, I do not carry a specific diagnosis of an autoimmune inflammatory arthritis. I, of course, have osteoarthritis because I'm 62 years old, and that's what happens when you get older. And I do suffer from very severe osteoporosis. And so I can understand, and I've had multiple fractures as a result of it. So I do understand what it is like to live with a chronic condition. But my my lot in life is to help people to live with their condition and live the fullest and best life possible.
That's amazing. I'm sorry. I did not know you. I thought you were like 49, like literally. So I'm just going to, yeah, that's amazing. You're amazing. And,
thank you.
Yeah. And I want to take a second to for people who haven't listened to the previous episode with a nurse practitioner, Corey Dewing, can you just explain a little bit the role of a nurse practitioner in rheumatology? Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's a great question. And I'm going to say that nurse practitioners and physician's assistants in the field of rheumatology are very similar. So you're really not going to be, as a patient, you're not going to see a difference. It's just how we got to that role that makes the difference. So physician assistants, I don't want to speak for them. I'm not a physician assistant, but generally speaking, they too get at least a master's degree. It's a postgraduate after a bachelor's program. They have a 2-year program that is very much rooted in medicine, and their whole curriculum is designed very similarly to the way that a physician's education is designed. And nurse practitioners go through, all nurse practitioners also have a master's, and now most of the programs are actually producing doctoral degrees. So you have, the difference is that nurse practitioners, you have to be a nurse first. So you have to have worked in nursing for the most part. Is not always the case anymore. Sometimes people are going all the way through school through a DNP program and never really actually worked on the floor. So, but again, the difference is more that PAs with that medical model come at patients with a medical perspective. Okay, here's the diseases, here's what we need to treat. Whereas nurse practitioners and nurses come from the perspective of, here are your symptoms and what do we need to do to make them better? If that means we recognize that you have a disease and we treat the disease, that's absolutely part of it. But we can't also then recognize that maybe you have a sleep issue, maybe you have huge stressors at home, maybe there are some significant social determinants of health that are impacting your ability to get the care that you need. So you're not getting it. So I can say this is what you have, I can say this is what you need to do, but that doesn't mean that's what's going to happen. And I think everyone in medicine is more focused on a shared decision-making process. I like to think that nurse practitioners excel at that.
Oh, that's such a beautiful way to put it. So just acronym alert as we go through this episode. Yeah, when you hear NP, that's nurse practitioner. When you hear PA, that's physician assistant. But one of the other things I would just quickly add, because people might be confused if they go to a rheumatology clinic and they think, well, the only person here who is authorized to like prescribe medications or, you know, be my main treatment plan coordinator is the rheumatologist, which is an MD, medical doctor. But no, at least I know I'm in Washington State. So I know in our state, NPs have almost all, not exactly all the same, but a lot of the same powers of prescribing and stuff and such.
Yeah. So that's,
yeah.
100%. You're absolutely correct. And I should have mentioned that I was sort of talking about preparation, but yes. Yeah. So how nurse practitioners and physician assistants are utilized in each practice will vary across the country, across the different states. But I'm in New York. And like you said, in Washington, I have full prescribing privileges. There are no restrictions whatsoever on what I can do. I would say that as you're out there and you're a person just maybe coming into the field of rheumatology and you don't know who should be taking care of you, nurse practitioners and physician assistants in many places do carry their own panel. What you're looking for is some experience. So because we didn't go to medical school, we do need to be experienced. I will tell you that for the first 7 years of my practice, I didn't see one patient without also having them see the physician. Mm-hmm. Now I'm 20 years in practice and I actually have my own panel and I bring the physicians in when I feel like I don't know how to handle a situation. Or if a patient says, can we have the physician come in? But for the most part, for the most practices, it's a team approach. So oftentimes the NP or the PA will go in and evaluate you, talk to you, get the history, and then bring the physician in. Okay, this is what my thoughts are. This is what I'm thinking of doing. Let's make a plan together. And then together you monitor over time.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I really do think with a chronic condition like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic, you know, where you're going to be living with this 24/7, right? The lifestyle variables, like you said, looking at sleep, stress management, non-pharmacological, tools and tips? I mean, I guess as an occupational therapist, that's also all that we don't do any prescribing or any, you know, so we right. are very passionate about that aspect too. So I definitely want to use our time partly to talk about, you know, your research and what you found are some of the best non-pharmacological pain management tools. It's hard to, I think you said earlier, you specialized in chronic pain in your research and in rheumatic disease, which I think I'm going to preface, this is how my brain works. I just have to think through my thoughts out loud, even though we already made this organized document of the questions. But before we go into the actual techniques, can you explain the difference between chronic pain that is from like an injury that then became a chronic pain versus a chronic ongoing condition like rheumatoid arthritis that cut? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I would say one of the biggest jobs that I do in terms of working with patients and teaching patients, is, especially with a chronic rheumatic disease, is to help them understand what is chronic pain from the fact that you've had chronic pain for a lot of years, and what is chronic pain that's inflammatory that requires we change your inflammatory treatment. I had a patient recently referred to me from one of the other rheumatologists in my practice, and the patient had a history of psoriatic arthritis, but also had chronic widespread pain for many, many years. So she was sent to me for her chronic widespread pain. And I evaluated her, and her psoriasis was out of control. Head to toe, her body surface area was more than 60, 70% covered, and she had active joint inflammation. And when I sent her back to the person who sent her to me, you know, I said, well, the first thing we have to do is we have to change her therapy because she's not under control. And I can't treat the chronic pain condition if there's an underlying inflammatory condition that's not under control. And so it's all about learning what to look for. And I think that I'm not sure how much of your community knows about the different inflammatory markers that we look at. Yeah. So there
but,
are
but
many.
First, sorry, just really quick, when you said the therapy, you are talking about medications, right? The
medication. In her case, therapy. I had to get her inflammatory condition under control before I can start treating the other conditions. So I have a few rules when it comes to chronic pain, and that is that you cannot treat chronic pain if you have ongoing inflammation, if you have a sleep disorder, and if you have a mood disorder that's not addressed, and or any other major stressor. So if those things are not addressed, there is nothing that you can do to treat someone's pain. And so trying to treat that pain with like a pain medicine while you haven't treated those other problems is only going to cause more problems. Mm. And that is what we saw in this last decade with the opioid use and abuse that happened. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when we say, you know, I think this is a really common area of confusion with the phrase chronic pain, because you're like, okay, I have a chronic disease called rheumatoid arthritis and I have pain, then therefore I have chronic pain. But normally in the research, you're actually, when we say the word chronic pain, providers are usually talking about that central sensitization, right? Or how would you describe
it? I mean, the term chronic pain is exactly what you say. It's just pain that lasts more than 3 months.
Okay. Yeah.
So then
not very specific.
It's not very specific. What you just did is you said a specific type of pain, and that is centralized pain. There are three different major types of pain. There's centralized pain is the one where the brain is processing pain incorrectly. It perceives things as painful that should not be painful. And then there is tissue-related pain, which is, you know, you have an inflamed joint, you have a broken bone. That is actually, I'm blanking on the name for it, and I'm sorry that I'm blanking on the name. Give me 2 seconds so I don't give you the wrong name.
That's okay.
It's funny. I just had this up because I wanted to make sure I didn't. Okay. So that's called, in the medicine world, we call that nociceptive pain.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that's the kind of pain from an injury, from inflammation. Then we have the third kind of pain is neuropathic pain. Mm-hmm. And neuropathic pain is nerves that are bothered. So carpal tunnel syndrome causes neuropathic pain. Diabetes that causes peripheral neuropathy, that's neuropathic pain. So I don't know your story. I know you have rheumatoid arthritis. I've seen you wear a lot of braces. I'm guessing there's a good chance you might have some carpal tunnel. So you just told me that there's the possibility that you could have nociceptive pain, neuropathic pain, and you've had pain for a long time that maybe hasn't always been treated. So you might also have an element of centralized pain. So in any one person, you can have all three types of pain. In most people that live with a chronic condition, there are all three types of pain.
And that's, I think you, first of all, thank you for providing that overview. And I think it's when you can't see the tissue damage because it's so far into your joint, right? Well, like with rheumatoid arthritis, I sometimes say that if I'm having a joint flare up, it feels like someone's squeezing my hand from the inside out, you know, not from the outside in, because you can feel it's from deep within. It's hard to know, is this central sensitization in the sense of my brain has become oversensitive to the perception of pain in my joint. And it's, there's a small amount of stimulus that's evoking a gigantic response. And it's actually the tissues are fine, or are the tissues not fine? How do I know?
Yes. So that is the grand boo-ha question. That's the question we're always trying to figure out. At every single visit that I have with a patient, that's what we're trying to figure out. But there are objective ways. So let me just talk a little bit about some of the objective ways to look for the pain. So again, I mentioned lab, right? So there's some blood work. There's something called the sedimentation rate, the ESR. This is something that we measure in almost all RA patients and almost all patients with a rheumatic disease. So that's one thing. And that should be generally between 20. I don't think I need to give you the numbers, but if you want me to, I can. Should be between
Mine's
20
like
and 30
right
or
now.
Less.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, that's a good sign to be at two, right? Mm-hmm. That means there's not a lot of systemic inflammation, but that's only one way to look for inflammation. We also can use something called the C-reactive protein. And that is one of the drivers actually that's associated with the inflammation we see with cardiovascular risk and rheumatic disease. So when that number is persistently elevated, and again, that number we always worry about when that number is well over 10 or 20, okay? And really, if I told you that patients who have acute COVID that were really, really sick, their C-reactive protein numbers were 300 and something. So the range is pretty massive. So you really have to have double digit numbers for it to be of a concern. Some other things that can tell us if there's inflammation in the body, you look at your CBC. So you don't need those fancy tests. You can just look at your blood count. Then you look at, are you anemic? Sometimes when the body is really inflamed, it's very hard for the body to, there's so much work that the bone marrow is doing to make all the inflammatory cells that it's not making enough of the, or it doesn't have the ability to make enough red blood cells. So you end up with anemia. It's called anemia of chronic disease. So we look at the blood count. And then we also look at our platelet count. When the body is terribly inflamed persistently and not controlled, the platelet count actually goes up. And it goes into the 400 or 500 range. And anything above that is like really severe inflammation. So those are some, there's some other tools, but those are the big ones that we look at. Those are lab tests that we can do. Most rheumatic diseases don't usually affect the white blood cell count. Lupus can cause your white blood count to go down, doesn't usually cause it to go up. And then infections usually cause the white count to go up. There are also some drugs that can cause some drugs, and specifically the IL-6 inhibitors are known to cause a decrease in white blood cell count and specifically neutrophil count. So those are the labs that we look at. And then if we're really still not sure, there's imaging that can be done. And the most effective and least expensive imaging is to do ultrasounds. And many clinics have ultrasounds right in the clinic. And you can come in and say, Christine, I really feel like my finger is swelling. And I look at your finger and I don't see anything. So I say, you know what, let's do a scan and let's see. And then if we see nothing, then yes, there's probably an element of centralized pain. If we see inflammation, then no, you probably have active inflammation that we haven't controlled fully.
Yeah, that's so, so helpful. So basically, if you concurrently, if I summarize this, if you have a rheumatic disease like psoriatic arthritis or RA, and you're having pain in the joints, and but you're not sure how much of it is from inflammation, and maybe is sometimes if you have a lot of inflammation, it's a sign that maybe you need to change your medication regimen and stuff. But you start off by, okay, what objective measures can we get to help us figure out? Yeah, we measure the inflammation through the blood work and the ultrasound or other imaging. And then it's really like a choose your own adventure. Like if this, then this, if, you know,
it is completely.
Yeah. And I know that some of these things are listed out in like the textbooks and stuff, you know, and then you say, okay, if you're still really having this persistent feeling of pain, even though we're saying all of your inflammation markers are low, and it doesn't mean that your pain's not real. It
100% does not mean that your pain is not real.
Yeah.
But now we need to just think about, okay, so what else are we missing? Right. So if that was, if you were in my office and I got to that point, and I'd say, okay, so I really think that what's going on is that you've had chronic pain for so long. You do have an element of centralized pain, and they've now got a bunch of different words for that. The other word they're using nowadays is nociplastic pain. That's the scientific word for that. But anyway, and that has a totally different treatment regimen. So for each of those three different types of pain, if you talk to me and you say that your pain is more burning and radiating, that sounds more nerve-like. So I'm going to use medicines that treat nerve pain. If you say it's more diffuse and all over the place, and it hurts for people to hug me, for my child to play with me, it's too painful, that I think of as more of that centralized pain. And there's a different treatment regimen for that kind of pain.
Yeah. So I think let's dive into those. I mean, if that's okay, like what, you know, because I'm really glad we took a minute to, or a few minutes to go over the different kinds of pain, because that's, that question is the foundation for the next question I was going to jump to, which is, what are the pain management techniques? Because you want to use the right tool for the right, like you were just describing.
Exactly, exactly. And it's often different from time to time, from visit to visit. And that's, I think, what you and your relationship with whomever your provider is needs to understand, that you're on a journey together. This is a marathon. It is not a sprint. There are not quick fixes, and we need to be patient, right? So one of the things that happens, if you're someone who's gone on to develop some centralized pain, and I will tell you that the rate of people with chronic rheumatic disease and centralized pain is very high. So for example, the epidemiology says that for Sjogren's disease, for example, 30 to 40% of the patients also have centralized pain. Mm-hmm. For rheumatoid arthritis, it's anywhere from 25 to 35% of people. For ankylosing spondylitis, it's even higher. And I think it's because of the delay in diagnosis. For lupus, it's also around 30, 40%. So if you're lucky enough to not have that, you don't have to worry about it at all. How did I get off on that tangent though? There's something else.
Oh, we were talking about treating the right kind of pain management techniques for the right, like matching technique to.
Oh, I know what I was going to say.
Yeah.
So if your provider hasn't recognized that there's a centralized component, what I see happen oftentimes is people are jumped from one biologic to another, to another, to another. So I know there's been some disconnect when I see someone who's been through, you know, seven different biologic agents. That shouldn't happen. I very infrequently will change an agent, because to me, you have to prove to me that it's inflammatory. Otherwise, I'm going to try other things. And I think that's better for the person, because then when you do really truly have a flare, there's still 15 things that you can go to. Whereas if I barrel through all of the other options, then you have a flare. We're stuck with, oh my God, she's tried everything and nothing's working. And that's never the case.
That's a tricky one, because I mean, again, not being an occupational therapist, is medications are beyond my scope, but I look into it so I can be more informed. And it does seem that there are people who have like that treatment resistant, you know, RA, where they might have to, so I don't want to go on that tangent too much, but I have seen some patients in my support groups where it's like, they tried the TNF inhibitors, they tried like the IL-6 inhibitors, and then all of a sudden they tried the JAK inhibitors, and it was like jackpot. Like, they, sometimes you do, right?
Yes. We're hoping one day to have precision medicine, right? Mm-hmm. That will be able to genetically determine, this is the kind of treatment you're going to need. You're an RA patient. You're going to respond to TNF inhibitors. You're going to respond to JAK inhibitors. You're going to respond to IL-6 inhibitors. Everyone is different. And unfortunately, it's a crapshoot right now, right? We have to try one thing, and then, and we're dictated oftentimes that trial, the order of what we're going to use is based on what insurance companies say. When a patient comes in and they say that my brother or my mother has got rheumatoid arthritis and they're doing great on this drug, because that tells me that this person probably will also do pretty well. And the other thing is understanding, as providers, we need to understand primary and secondary failure. Have you ever heard that expression?
I've heard, but I can't remember what it means.
So primary failure is if I put you on a drug and it's in a certain category, and in the first 3 months you had absolutely no reaction, just didn't do anything for you, just was not a drug that your body responded to. That would be considered a primary failure. But if I put you on a drug and you did great for a year,
that's what I've had. Okay.
So that's a secondary failure. And so what the recommendation is to stay within that class if you've had a secondary failure. So if I started you on a TNF and you did great, but you stopped, it stopped working for you after a year or two, you should at least stay within that category for another time or two and see what happens. Now, if the time that you stay in remission is shorter and shorter, it's clearly time to move on, right? Mm-hmm. But if you never had a response, you shouldn't stay within that.
My rheumatologist must have, because I started on Enbrel and then my body developed antibodies to Enbrel. So then I went to Remicade. Both of those are the TNF inhibitors. And it wasn't, Remicade worked great until after my pregnancy, and my, you know, your immune system can kind of get wackadoodle after that. And anyway, that's a long other story, because at the time the recommendation was to go off the Remicade during the last trimester, because that's what they thought. That was 2013, 2014, but now you stay on it. But anyway, so if we go back a second and think, okay, so if you have rheumatoid arthritis, which most people listening have something similar, whether it's, you know, ankylosing spondylitis,
psoriatic arthritis,
So it seems like the first line of defense is get that under control as much as you can. And then if you're like, wow, like all of your inflammation markers are really good, and I don't see any signs on your ultrasound of inflammation, then I've seen so many patients who say, my doctor said, well, I can't do anything for you because I don't see any active signs of inflammation. But the patient's like, well, right, I can't function in life right now because I have so much pain. So you're like, okay, so this is where in your mind, you know, talking to you, Dr. Stamatos, it's like, you know that, okay, this is just another step in this process of determining you still have pain. This is limiting your ability to function in life. This is maybe the nociplastic or centralized sensitization kind of pain. Now let's talk about the treatments for that, you know? So,
Right. Can I go back to inflammatory real quickly?
This is our time. We get to do whatever we want.
one of the other signs of the difference between an inflammatory and a non-inflammatory pain is range of motion. So typically,
I should know this as OT. Yeah.
Yeah, you should know. Typically, when you're actively inflamed, there's a limited range of motion. Mm-hmm. And I'm using that differently than the word stiffness, because people who have chronic, widespread, centralized pain describe stiffness all day long. Mm-hmm. So you really can't use that word. So even though that's typically when we teach people, when I teach providers how to recognize inflammatory versus non-inflammatory pain, I teach them, listen, if there's stiffness that lasts more than 15 to 30 minutes, that's abnormal, that's inflammatory. You know, you need to get to the root of where that inflammation is coming from. But from a patient perspective, I think I would focus more on range of motion. So when your RA, for example, is really active, you can't raise your arms or you can't make a fist. But when that gets under control and it's a centralized pain, you should still be able to raise your arm and make a fist. It may hurt to do it. It may feel stiff to do it, but you should be able to do it.
And you're talking about active range of motion, not passive.
Yes.
Because in OT, we sometimes do like passive range of motion where can someone move your joint through? But no, in the rheumatology, we're talking about active. If the patient can do it themselves.
I am, but you're absolutely right, right? So there are still some centralized pain states where people think they can't move, and then I can move them passively very easily.
Yeah.
So then that also is a measure of not inflammation.
But it also could be muscle weakness, and it could be, and then you're like, if it's weakness, is it from underuse because you're in pain and then you're not moving? And so it's just so complex.
But I appreciate that you said that, because deconditioning is one of the biggest problems that we have, right?
Yes.
And here's another statement. You asked me about mantras earlier. One of my mantras is, I talk to people about pain, and pain is supposed to tell you that a problem is happening in the body. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to then stop what we're doing so that we don't make the pain worse. That's true in an acute nociplastic or nociceptive pain state, an acute tissue painful state.
Tissue is hurt. Yeah.
Tissue is injured. Tissue is bothered. There's something wrong with it. But when there's no tissue injury, that is not the case. And what happens is people do less and less, and then they're less able to do as much. And then when they start to be active, everything hurts. So then they say, well, you told me I had to exercise, and I went out and then I couldn't do anything for 3 days. Well, then you started exercising incorrectly. And we can talk about that later. But so I'm going to go back to my word range of motion, because I really do think range of motion, whether it's active or passive, does help us differentiate from active tissue damage versus no tissue damage.
That's super helpful. And this is, I'm sorry, I'm going to go on a related tangent to range of motion, but I really wish that I had been referred when I was first diagnosed to a certified hand therapist, which is like an occupational therapist or physical therapist. They have, and so I'm an occupational therapist, but I did not do the additional 5,000 hours and board exam to become what's just called a CHT, a certified hand therapist. But I can, like, as an OT, we are at our baseline, you know, can help treat disorders of the hand. But long story short, we have all these little tiny, like, literally they're called goniometers, right? They look like little tiny, those math tools, you know, that you use, like the, I don't know, what are they called? Like the thing that you make a circle with, in math. Anyway, point being, they can measure. Yeah. The compasses and stuff, but they're like, anyway, I have literally, it's hilarious. My son and his friends like take it cause they think it's fun. Like they like,
oh, it is a goniometer. It measures how much you can bend.
Yeah. And they, and what would be, what I wish I had been able to do that at the very beginning to get a baseline. So at your diagnosis, what is your active and passive range of motion? And then you could see, like, I have slight deformities in my knuckles, not that bad given that it's been 21 years since my diagnosis. Right. But it would be so helpful to be able to track and monitor that over time. Because the problem is when you wait till things are really bad to get that evaluation referral, then you're like, well, I don't even know, what is your baseline supposed to be, right? Because is this just the progression of your disease? So if I could say it in like caveman terms, like central sensitization means no tissue injury, right? It means but your brain is very, very much really having a real signal to your brain that there is pain. I remember I had Dr. Afton Hassett came from her clinic on the podcast in Michigan and talked about how they do brain scans of people with like fibromyalgia. And you know, you have a clinic that does fibromyalgia and long COVID. But is that correct?
So can I talk about that?
Yeah.
Can I talk a little bit about that? So through the work of places like University of Michigan, between the brain scans, which are amazing, they actually show that parts of the brain light up in a more exaggerated way in somebody with centralized pain than someone who doesn't have that. But it's more detailed than that. They actually also looked at the messages going up to the brain and the neurotransmitters responsible for communicating that pain. And they measured spinal fluid. And in the spinal fluid of people with chronic pain, fibromyalgia specifically, they found that they created more than three times the amount of something called substance P. And substance P is the chemical neurotransmitter that sends a message to the brain that there's pain here. And so people with fibro have more substance P. They also have higher levels of glutamate, which is an irritable neurotransmitter that turns all these nerves on and you know, gets everything all excited. And they have high levels of, and this is the reason, I'll tell you in a second, high levels of endorphins. So why do you think there's high levels of endorphins? Well, the body says, hey, there's a lot of pain here. So let me give you the endorphin that you need to give you relief, right?
Right.
The problem is the body creates so much of it that there aren't enough receptors for that endorphin to act on. And so you end up with the problems, the side effects from it without the benefit of getting the pain relief. So that's part of the broken system in centralized pain. And it's also part of why people with centralized pain should avoid opioids. Because what we found is that these people, when you have this kind of centralized pain, we're just feeding more endorphins into that, because an opioid is an exogenous or an outside form of an internal endorphin. So you end up with these high levels of endorphins and exogenously or endogenously, and you don't get the pain relief. Instead, you get the fatigue, you get the discognition, you get the constipation, you get the lack of energy. All of that is what you get without necessarily pain relief. And we thought there was no ceiling. So for years in the 1990s, we were taught just keep giving people more pain medicine. They just need pain medicine. And we were actually making the situation far worse.
Oh my gosh. We should do a separate episode all on like demystifying opioids, because it's definitely.
You should, because I came across a statistic last week. See if I can get this right. More people died in one day from opioid related disease or use disorder is the way you're supposed to say it now than in the entire year in the 1990s.
Wow. And it's not, and I always feel defensive for chronic pain patients because I want it to be known that it's not the chronic pain patients that cause this epidemic. It's
no.
It's definitely not. And there are people who are very responsible opioid users, but I'm going to refrain from getting on that.
No, but that goes back to
endorphins,
yeah. Identifying the reason for your pain. Right. Mm-hmm, so if I treat a nociceptive, if I treat a tissue injury pain with the right medicine, I get the right pain relief. If I try that same treatment for centralized pain, I won't get the right pain relief. If your pain is nerve pain and I throw an opioid at it, it's not going to work as well. So when I have someone come in with an acute herniated disc and they've got pain running down their leg, that sciatica that people talk about, right? If I give that person an opioid, it's not going to work as well. What I need to give that person is something to calm that nerve down. I need to reduce the inflammation of that nerve. So I usually use something like a steroid and or an anti-inflammatory. And then I need to give something to calm the nerve itself down.
If you have ever felt completely lost or utterly alone while trying to navigate real life with rheumatic disease, listen up. I am here for you. I created an educational program to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks, and it's called Room to Thrive. After earning a master's in occupational therapy and completing hundreds of hours of additional training, I created a step-by-step guide to help you truly thrive with rheumatic disease. This is the only program I know of that's designed to improve quality of life for people living with inflammatory, autoimmune forms of arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, Sjogren's disease, and more. During the self-paced lessons, you'll learn how to manage pain and fatigue, cope with stress, navigate relationships, and continue doing the things that matter to you and bring you joy. The goal is really to help you improve your quality of life and learn how to thrive with your rheumatic disease right now, rather than waiting for a distant day when it might be cured or healed. I really created the down-to-earth, practical, heartfelt resource I wish I had had when I was first diagnosed at age 20. If you want even more in-depth support, you can join the 12-week Room to Thrive virtual support group, where you'll be surrounded by people who actually get what you're going through, people who will provide the encouragement, validation, and support that you deserve. Each group is expertly moderated, so you don't have to worry about the kind of misinformation that spreads like wildfire in the free-for-all social media groups. If you're on the fence, don't just take my word for it. Here's what Katie had to say in March 2023. I was lost and overwhelmed with my RA diagnosis. It felt overwhelming to know what to read, what to do, how to spend my energy trying to research on the internet. Room to Thrive did that for me. It's been like getting a crash course in my diagnosis along with a community who gets it. To see all the details, including the dates for the next support groups, go to the link in the show notes or bit.ly/thriveroom with a capital T and capital R. You can also just email me anytime at info@myarthritislife.net. And don't delay if you're interested, because each group is capped at 16 people or less in order to make a small, intimate group atmosphere. Thanks so much for your time, and I can't wait to get started with the next groups. And I can't wait for those of you who are interested in the self-paced option to go ahead and join that at any time. Bye-bye for now.
Right. Well, and that, I mean, already this has been so helpful. But I want to zoom into the methods, non-pharmacologic methods for managing rheumatoid arthritis, not just the pain itself, but actually like the inflammation in general and just things that we can do in our lifestyle things that
lifestyle you found. Things. Yes.
Yeah. I just talked to our, where I'm about to put out an episode from our friend, the physical therapy based episode on the, 2022 ACR, American College of Rheumatology guidelines for integrative treatments, including exercise, but for Kimberly, but let me, what do you think of when you, what do you talk with your patients about when it comes to these non-pharmacologics?
So my very first approach, again, I mentioned at the beginning that sleep is a critical issue.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the statistics in this country, our sleep is definitely an issue between work and stressors and pain. There's so many things that impact our sleep, and it's an easy thing to start attacking. So the very first thing I always, whenever I meet a patient, is I ask them, how is your sleep? Do you have any issues with sleep? The question is, do you have trouble falling asleep? Do you have trouble staying asleep? When you wake up, do you feel like you had a good night's rest? If the answer is yes, I feel well rested. No, I don't have any trouble falling. No, I don't have trouble staying asleep. I don't have to worry about sleep in that person. They're completely covered. But I've had patients come to me and I can't get them better. And then, you know, we've tried all these other things and I finally go, okay, clearly I'm missing something. Tell me more about your sleep. And then I have them do things like show me their watch and their timing. And I have these young women that are, you know, they're mothers and they're working full time and they're going to graduate school and they don't go to sleep until 2 a.m. and then they're up at 6 a.m. Well, you only gave yourself 4 hours of sleep, right?
Yeah.
So what we know about autoimmune and autoinflammatory diseases is that they're generally worse if the body is stressed. So you want to do whatever you can to minimize stress. So one of the biggest questions I get all the time is somebody comes to me because they have a positive rheumatoid factor and maybe even a positive CCP, which is that really sensitive marker for rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. And they say, okay, but I don't have any disease. What do I need to do to prevent it from coming on, right? Mm-hmm. And I go through a whole litany of, okay, well, make sure that you're sleeping really well. Make sure that you have all the sleep hygiene skills that you need, you know, and you're employing all of them. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you're eating a healthy, well-balanced, anti-inflammatory diet. You're minimizing processed foods. You're minimizing red meat. You're minimizing dairy. We know all of those things trigger inflammation, right? So nutrition is mm-hmm. huge. And nutrition is not something you hear often because we, especially physicians, and so I think PAs as well, because again, their educational training is modeled very much more on the medicine model, which is they don't treat nutrition at all, or mm-hmm. have not. I should say that's changing. I have a scribe right now and she's applying to medical school, and the school that she likes the best has a mandatory plant-based nutrition class. And I was just like beside myself excited to hear that. So that's super crazy exciting. So nutrition absolutely matters. What we put into our mouth makes a difference. And then managing stress, right? So if you're that person who's trying to raise kids, work full time and go to graduate school, and you don't have a good support system to make that all happen, then you're going to have problems. And when I look back to the patients that I've had, often I meet them when they're going through the middle of a stressor, and that's what turned their disease on. So, I mean, I had this young woman who came to me with, the first time I met her, she had a black eye and she was in the middle of not a healthy relationship and she was trying to get out of it. And that was the presentation of her lupus. Over the next 2 years, she was good enough to say, I'm getting out of this situation. It's clearly not right. But every time he took her to court, her platelet count would drop.
Yeah.
So we actually preemptively dosed her with steroids before she had to go to court so that that wouldn't happen and she wouldn't end up in the hospital anymore. But so my point is that often these diseases are turned on and then worsened by stress.
Yeah. The Harvard University Press has this really good, it's like a 70-page digital download book called like Understanding Chronic Inflammation. I'll find it. I'll put it in the show notes. But I printed it out because I was like, this is such a helpful resource. As I think that it goes into the science of how does stress, you know, trigger this. And it doesn't mean that you're like, a lot of times people feel like, oh, well, they're just telling me that like, it's all my fault. No, this is a human thing.
No, not at all.
No.
Yeah.
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 And that the good news is we can do something about it, you know?
And on that same line, so that's the emotional stress that you're experiencing in your life, right? But there is a stress on your body. So not taking care of your body, not exercising, not maintaining a healthy weight also puts tremendous stress. Specifically weight, we know to be its own problem. So obesity and the fat cells, the adipose cells that we have in our body, they produce inflammatory cytokines. And yeah. those cytokines are what drive the inflammation. Cytokine is just a magical word for a chemical that triggers inflammation in the body. And right. then smoking. We know that smoking has got a huge association with rheumatoid arthritis. It's what drives the formation of that cyclic citrullinated protein, which is that CCP, that antibody that drives the disease. So the more you smoke, the more you make that antibody, the higher. And I always tell my patients that think of those antibodies and the drugs that we use, our attempt is to reduce the antibodies. And it's like changing your army, right? If my army is big and strong, then the attack is much worse. But if I can lower those antibodies, make your army smaller, and then the attack is less intense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I do think, you know, it's very overwhelming as a patient. Like, I'm trying to imagine people being like, whoa, I have to exercise and do my nutrition and stress and sleep. You know, like, and it's that I am actually more stressed thinking about all the things I have to do. but you know, I often say in my Room to Thrive, you know, program is all teaching people in bite-sized chunks about these different things. And I think it is really always a helpful little guidance, word of wisdom, I guess I would say, is to start with one, you know, be like, this week.
I was going to say one.
What do you think? Yeah.
Just one step. That's all you ever need to do. Mm-hmm. One step, one day. You know, again, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Mm-hmm. So can I give you the one other definite analogy that I love for dealing with chronic pain, which I think you've heard it before. And that is from Penny Cowan, who is one of the founders of the American Chronic Pain Association. Mm-hmm. And she, I've morphed it. I'm not sure if I bastardized her description of it, but it works for me. And I think it makes sense when I describe it to patients, but she describes living with chronic pain, like driving your car and having tires flat. Mm-hmm. And you have to fill your different tires with different things. And if you only focus on one tire, you're not going to move smoothly through life, right? You need all four tires to be smooth to move forward. So one tire is Western medicine, surgery, medications, injections, things that we can do to you. And all too often in this world, people focus on that tire and they don't think about all the other things. So that's what we can do for you. And that's the people who only focus there are the ones that keep coming back to me saying, but I'm not getting better. That's because you still have three flat tires. So now you got to go to the other tire. The second tire is your physical strength and endurance. So that's the food you put into your body. That's the sleep that you allow yourself to get. That's the strength that you have around your muscles to support your joints.
Yep.
That's all of those, the weight that you maintain, that's a whole second tire. But let's say you take all the right medicine and you exercise and eat right and sleep right, you still have two other tires that could be flat, right? So the third tire is your physical worth, your value, the social connections that you make in this world, the fact that you need to maintain them. And all too often, people who live with a chronic condition, especially when it's painful, they slowly extract people from their lives. They start to have a smaller and smaller pool because they feel like they can't be reliable. And it's just a frustrating situation.
Yeah. And sometimes they're forced to, because, or not forced to, but they're, the people in their life say, you know, you're too much for me. Like, and I had some, I'm just saying for the record that it's really upsetting sometimes that, you know, I've had people in my support groups who, you know, their husband left them because they're like, you're just too much for me. And it's just like, wow. Yeah. Okay. Like quality over quantity, I always say with social connections, but sorry. So that's your third is.
So you are so right. Quality over quantity, 100%.
Yeah.
You need a few good connections in this world and you don't need more, really. That's all that matters in this world. Who are the people, who are the five people that are going to be there for you when you're really down? Those are the people that matter. I think that's the number they say. If we all had five people that we can call. Yeah, it's between 5 and 10. But anyway,
okay, I'm gonna check that off my list. Tire.
Yeah. and then the fourth tire is, and Afton Hassett would love this one, right? It's all the self-management things that you can do for your own. So it's the ability to pace and learning what the value of pacing is. It's the ability to change your thoughts when they don't work for you, when the thoughts are working against you. Oh, I'm a loser. I can't meet up with everybody. I can't keep up with the workload. People are going to think I'm a terrible worker. I'm a terrible mother. All of that, being able to recognize that you're doing that and changing those thought patterns, that's a whole nother tire. your ability to problem solve, knowing that, let's say you're going to Hawaii and you've just run this podcast and you have to hurry up and clean it and get it online and you've got to pack and you have to take care. Knowing that you have those 15 things, if you plan ahead and you organize your life, you don't have to end up with a terrible pain flare. But if you don't have any of those tools in your pocket or your armamentarium, then you don't do those things and you end up flaring miserably, A, from a pain perspective, but also often turning on your disease more.
It almost sounds, that's a little bit like an executive. I would almost lump that in my head into like executive functioning and like emotional self-management too.
It's all about that. It's about also learning how to manage your thoughts, manage your emotions, manage your energy, right? And so knowing how to do things like meditate, knowing how to take yourself, you can recognizing, oh, I'm getting really stressed here. So learning how to take deep breaths so you don't let that stress get out of control. Those are all what we call self-management tools. And that's a whole tire in and of itself. So you need all four of those things all the time. And it's just like the gas pump. You got to constantly go and fill it up, right? So you got to fill up those social connections. You got to retrain the body on making sure that you didn't overschedule and that you are taking good care of yourself. And you've got to make sure, oh, let me relook. The holidays just came. I wasn't eating well. Let me revamp that. And you know, making sure that if you're on medications, you're taking them properly. And if you're not tolerating them, don't just stop them. Talk to your provider about, hey, I don't like this side effect. Can we come up with something else? If you don't have that kind of an open relationship with your provider, then you need a different provider.
100%. And I love this analogy. And I don't know whether I tend to make things maybe overcomplicated, but I think sometimes I would imagine it almost being like a dynamically sized tires situation where sometimes you're putting more into one, or you're noticing that one of them is giving you more back, like in different like seasons of your life, or maybe each tire is actually composed of like four different mini tires, like maybe with the sleep, endurance, and strength, you might find in a nutrition, you might find you get a bigger bang for your buck it on one versus the other. Like, I don't, do you find that, like for me, for example, nutrition does not seem to have a very immediate effect for me on inflammation. I follow generally 80% of the time anti-inflammatory eating pattern, 20% of the time chocolate. But you know, it just, whereas when I started adding strength training to my exercise regimen of cardio, it was immediate benefit to my brain fog, my fatigue, overall robustness. You know, so do you find that similar with your patients that they might find like one of these variables moves the needle for them?
Well, so you said you just froze and I don't know why you're frozen.
Oh no.
But you're frozen.
I still see you.
We talked before about sleep and I would say that sleep is the number one issue, but I think we have to fix the fact that you're frozen.
Okay. I'm not frozen to me.
You asked me if some different, ask me if some of the different tires maybe have different components and if different aspects of the components, you know, really make a big difference. And I do believe they do. I think there are, that's why, because I often have such a short period of time with patients, I do focus on things like sleep. Sleep is one of the, you get a night's sleep, you're dramatically different. I mean, there are numerous studies showing that a lack of sleep leads to chronic pain. Or leads to more pain. There's a study, the very first study that was done, I think it's one of the very first studies done in Canada, and I'm blanking on the name of the author, and I have it in my lectures. Hold on, I can tell you 2 seconds. Moldofsky, Moldofsky. He did one of the very first studies in the early 1970s, and he took a healthy group of college students, and he woke them up at intermittent times. After 1 week, they started to hurt. After 2 weeks, they felt like they were hit by a Mack truck.
Oh my gosh.
And most of the people you gave them the sleep back, they did better. One guy went on to develop fibromyalgia. And the word on the street that I've read in the literature on him is that this one person actually sued him for causing this chronic pain state. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but my point is, think about it. Think about what you feel like when you get a crappy night's sleep. The next day you feel so much more poorly. So for me, that's so easy. And should we talk a little bit about sleep now and just like what the sleep hygiene things are?
Yeah. I think I was going to just add one of the studies that I cite in the Room to Thrive course that I found morbidly fascinating. It's the this study in 2012 in the journal just called Sleep, a medical journal called Sleep. Sleep exacerbates fatigue, depression, and pain in rheumatoid arthritis. And they did the same thing you're talking about. They subjected people with rheumatoid arthritis to a sleep deprivation condition, like a randomized control. Oh my gosh, people were in so much worse pain and fatigue. It's not surprising, but you do have to validate these things with research. But okay, so yeah, what else? What can we do to sleep better?
So the first thing, how many, if I could see all the people that might be listening to this, could raise your hands, how many of you would say that you look at a device within 15 minutes of going to bed? Probably most people.
92%.
I hope you're not one of those people.
I stopped that in literally, and I'm sad to say, because I'm literally taught people to do it. It's like, do as I say, not as I do. I finally stopped in about November 23rd, 2023. I stopped looking. I had to physically put my phone out of the room. That's the only way I can do it. I charge my phone outside the bedroom.
And that is key. That's what everyone should be doing, right? So the point is, you could still look at a device, but you have to put it in night mode. And it needs to be one continuous thing that you're looking at. Mm. Not a movie per se. It really should be a quiet book in a perfect world. Yep. But the point is, if you're looking at email, or you're looking at TikTok, or you're looking at an Instagram, every new screen that you see opens your brain and wakes you back up again. And the brain goes, okay, it's not time to go to sleep. So of course you're going to have trouble going to sleep. And it is incredibly, incredibly easy to fix. That is a behavioral technique that is very easy to fix. So that's the very first thing that I say. And then the other basic principles of sleep hygiene are that you go to bed every day at the same time, you wake up at the same time. If you, you're supposed to use your bed for just sleep and sex and nothing more. You shouldn't be eating. You shouldn't be playing games in your, you could play some games, but they have to be sex-related games.
I mean, some of this starts seeming a little, I feel like, this is just me being in the weeds as an OT, but I'm like, you really have to customize this to the person, because this is not going to,
you do. But just some basic things, like your room should be cool. If your room is too warm, you tend to, it wakes you up, right? Mm-hmm. Your room should be dark. We know that you go into a deeper sleep state if you have a darker room. So those are some basic principles, right? The other really important principle that people don't usually employ is that you should spend at least 30 minutes outside every day.
That's, in Seattle, you want to be exposed to some sun, right?
Sun in a perfect world. But
for your circadian rhythm.
It's just fresh air. And with that also is motion, right? You're going to sleep better if you're more physically active. So I have a patient I just saw last week who spends more than 12 hours of his day in bed and then spends the rest of his day in bed. I mean, so basically he's in his bed almost all the time. And then he tells me he can't tolerate even physical therapy. Well, that's because you have so deconditioned yourself, but then also complains that he can't sleep. Well, you can't sleep because you're not active. So, being active is part of, it is a very vicious cycle.
For people listening, you can, if you are bed bound, you can absolutely do physical therapy from bed there. It's about you start with moving your muscles against gravity. And that is the challenge that your body can do right then. Start there. It's not all hope is lost if you're mostly in bed. Anyway, okay, continue.
I would say if you're mostly in bed, no, all hope is not lost. I typically, with people that are that deconditioned, I actually don't start with physical therapy. I start with occupational therapy.
Well, that's what I am. So that's perfect. I like hearing that.
So, I try to work with occupational therapists that can help people to be able to get up, be able to make their bed, be able to make their breakfast, be able to, and in between, if you have to basically be sitting or lying down most of the time, then that's fine. But we do a slow progressive increase. And so some of the other tools that I use are things like step counters, because, and I tell people when I first meet them, don't change anything. Let me see what it is at baseline. If at baseline your steps are 200 steps a day, okay, fine. We're going to slowly increase those steps. And you will be able to if you do it in a slow, progressive, and graded way, as as occupational therapist. But oftentimes you need that objective measure.
And I think and it's so important to measure your progress against yourself. And this is where the social media can be such a positive and a negative thing. Cause I sometimes share things like, wow, like here's a video of me. I'm literally at a gym because that's where my body's at right now today. I'm able to go to a gym and lift weights, but I'm always so sensitive to you know, there's responses I get when people are like, well, that's not realistic for me. I can't do that. You know? And it's like, no, but for me, it's, I'm trying to do a little bit more than I did last week. You know, I'm trying to get a little stronger than I was. So if what you're at is that it's really hard for you to walk from your house to your mailbox and you get fatigued doing that, you're going to work up to being able to work, you know, go, hey, go to the mailbox today, do some things to strengthen yourself. Then can you go 5 steps past the mailbox, 10 steps? And that's what we celebrate and get people excited about, your improvement, and don't get distracted. You got to kind of stay in your lane and don't compare yourself to people who are, you know, and just at a different place than you, you know, sorry, side note. But.
So no, that's fine. No, it's not. That's a super important one. One of my other tools I use on that same note is I say, okay, what could you comfortably do without feeling like you have to sit down for an hour afterwards or without feeling like you're done for 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. If you tell me I went for a 2 mile walk, but then I couldn't move for 2 days, well, then you did way too much. So you need to figure out what you can do comfortably. And then I tell people to start at 50% of that. So if you can walk to that mailbox and not be bothered, then I want you to start walking to that mailbox every single day, halfway. Mm-hmm. Every day, be intentional, put the shoes on and start by walking to that mailbox half the way every single day, whatever your measure is, and then slowly, progressively increase it. So that you have to move. You will not get better if you don't move. And, you know, so you ask, what are some other things? That's pretty up there. Sleep, movement.
Yeah. And, you know, I know I want to be sensitive to the amount of time we have time left, but I'm curious, you know, we're talking about with rheumatic disease, people with like rheumatoid arthritis are similar. Now we're talking about, like, what are the non-pharmacological things that they can do? First, like fibromyalgia or central sensitization, which someone might have with, you know, they might concurrently have that kind of pain along with their rheumatoid arthritis. So they may have it separately. The nociplastic pain, where their tissues might be, some degree of their tissues are not damaged. Let's just say an idea for sake of example, somebody who does not have RA, who just has fibromyalgia, let's say, for example, are some of these the same things that they'd be doing?
Totally the same. I don't change it at all. It's really no different. Okay. Right.
That was kind of my leading question. I just want to make sure.
Yes, I would go through the same exact mantra. And as you mentioned, everything that I say is completely individualized. So let's go back to that car, right? Let's go back to the four tires. When I meet you, when you come to my practice, I have a 12-page intake and it looks at what is your living situation? What is your work situation? What is your history of pain? What is your history? What's your family history? What treatments have you tried? What's your sleep like? What's your mood like? I ask all of those questions and then I focus a coordinated effort with the patient. We negotiate what do we need to do to fill those tires? And it's gonna be different for every single person. So I'm always asked, Christine, you specialize in fibromyalgia, how do you treat that? And my answer is, there is no one treatment. It's an individualized process and it's different for different people at different times. You know, so when you just had your new baby, right? It's completely a different set of needs that you had then than you might have now as you're trying to work and manage a child and manage a family, right? The totally different demands on you. So what you need to do is different in those states.
Yeah, you're really addressing like the context of someone's life has a huge impact on function. And I think that's what people are missing when they're looking for, like, what's the formula? What's the formula for me to decrease my pain? It's not, I think of that meme from The Notebook. It's not that simple. But you have
it is not that simple. Yeah. but so imagine, like, if I took you, you're going along, you're doing fine, you're managing everything because you've got all these different techniques in place, but your mother gets sick. And now you've got to add to that regimen taking care of your mother. And this is reality. This is the kind of stuff that happens all the time. So then you come to me and you're flaring, and I can't get your R. I had this woman. she had been so well controlled for years on this one treatment. And all of a sudden she came in and she was out of control. And we just thought, okay, well, maybe the drug stopped working for you. So we made a switch to another drug. Didn't go through all the details of what else might be happening, because she was always just such a straightforward RA patient and, mm-hmm. you know, responded well to treatment. And a second visit and a third visit, she was no better. And I'm like, what the heck? So finally I said to her, what's going on in your life? And her son had been arrested and was in court, and she was going through the middle of the trial with him, you know, yeah. So there was nothing I could do to get her RA under control without recognizing and helping her through that aspect of a super crazy, oof. Difficult time. Right.
That hits,
and we just, yeah, we don't take the time, unfortunately, in a lot of our medicine, because we have 15 minutes with somebody. So it's, again, really important that you form a good, strong, trusting relationship with your provider so that you can go in and say, hey, it's been a really crappy 3 months. This is what just happened. So that then I, as a provider, can say, okay, I know I need to sort of adjust and maybe look at things differently than I would have if you were still moving along fine.
Yeah, or and refer potentially to the providers like occupational therapy. We get 50 minutes with the patient. Now, that's assuming the insurance approves it.
Right.
It's really annoying. But point being, like, and that's, you know, I feel like I'm going to give you, like, if I had the power, I know people in high places, I can give you an honorary occupational therapy doctorate, because like what you're talking about is the exact, so that exact we call it like an occupational profile, which is our intakes are very similar. We talk about not just the internal factors of, you know, what's your pain, fatigue, stuff like that, but the external, extrinsic barriers or extrinsic supports to your function. You know, I always say, like, somebody with mild RA by nature of having mild RA in terms of maybe their inflammatory markers, doesn't by nature of having mild RA have a mild impact on their quality of life. Because if they have mild right. RA with zero social and environmental supports, that person's going to function worse than somebody with more moderate to severe RA. And in my case, I'll give myself as an example. I had every possible socioeconomic advantage when I got diagnosed, other than being male. I had every other advantage. I didn't even get my diagnosis until my parents hired a concierge doctor. Like, I was not believed by ever, and she didn't believe me initially either, that I was sick. She thought I was too anxious and I had an eating disorder, which I did not have. I had severe rheumatoid cachexia, going from captain of my college soccer team. Oh my God. Team. I get so angry. Talk about this 21 years later. I went from being 130 pounds, all muscle practically, to 105 pounds, and no one believe me that I wasn't trying to lose the weight. And I was so, and well, I will say, sorry, for the record, you also, those of you listening to the game are like, oh my God, she's going on her rampage again. I only had one joint. I only had one joint that I would say was painful. And I'm an athlete. I'm used to pushing through. Yeah. Like, yeah. If I really think about it, I'm like, yeah, my elbows were a little sore and stuff. This did not register at all on my scale of importance of life. You know, I was just like, I have the sprained finger for like a year. That was not, so I'm not saying that they should have diagnosed me with RA, but I'm saying that they should have believed me that something else more was wrong. I'm so sorry. I don't remember how we even got on this tangent. Oh,
no, but so let me tell you what I tell supports. People about fibro.
Yeah. Yeah.
When someone comes to me and I don't know what they have, and maybe right now all I can diagnose them with is fibromyalgia, I tell them, listen, I'm not saying you don't have something. We are always going to look, because this is a diagnosis of exclusion. I hear you. I know you're uncomfortable. We need to get you to get some quality of life back. I don't know what medications to use perhaps to treat an underlying condition, because I haven't figured out what that is yet, but what you're experiencing is real. Yes. And let's figure out how we can help you.
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm literally like healing in my heart. Like I do this in my head. Sometimes I think about how my experience could have been different if I had someone like you, honestly, because it's really unfortunate that so many patients get put through the ringer. And I remembered my initial point was just to say that even though I had moderate to severe RA at my diagnosis, the fact that I had such incredible supports, not just socioeconomic, but family, emotional support from my parents, you know, social support, great boyfriend, sister, best friend, you know, friends from my soccer team. And I had, you know, it was like a seamless process getting me on, no insurance barriers, got me on to Enbrel, went back to college to finish my senior year. I'm at a level of functioning that is a lot higher than somebody who just, quote unquote, just got diagnosed with only mere mild rheumatoid arthritis with they're a single parent, they've got multiple kids, they are responsible for everything, their stress level is high, they don't have good insurance like that. So we can't just look at the internal variables like severity of the disease. You have to look at the context that the person's living in. That was the end.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. I agree with you.
We agree. We should rule the world. Everyone should be like us. That's all my podcasts go to eventually. No. But so I also want to use the time that we have to give you the floor to talk a little bit more about your long COVID and fibromyalgia clinic. I'm just so fascinated by this. What are you looking at? What are you finding? Tell me everything.
Well, so I started it because with fibromyalgia, don't have a place to go. They don't really live anywhere, right? So they kind of fall under rheumatology, kind of fall under neurology, kind of fall under PM&R, and nobody really generally is very interested in taking care of them. People that live with chronic pain are it's a time-consuming process to get to the bottom of it, to figure out what in that four paradigm you need to tweak. That mm-hmm. takes time. And I was not having that time seeing patients in a regular clinic where I have a half an hour for a new patient, 15 minutes for a return patient. So I said, I need to create something different and I want to be able to give something different. So the idea was to see patients in this clinic. And really I try to tell people that what I am is a coach and I'm just kind of here to tell you what tools are out there, but I can't do that. You have to then do it.
Yes.
So, you know, Coach Reed can tell his team to do all the right things, but unless they carry it out, they're not going to win the Super Bowl, right? Yep. I mean, Patrick Mahomes, he took it upon himself to run that touchdown almost all the way in and then throw the final throw. That was on him in that last moment. So that's what I try to tell people is what I'm able to offer. But what I offer is my holistic approach mm-hmm. and that comprehensive intake. And they also have a time before they come to see me. Every patient gets 15 minutes with a pharmacist and they go through all their pharmacology because the polypharmacy that we see is just so outrageous. But also I can't think about how to treat you if I don't know what you've tried before. So that's really, really important. Mm-hmm. And then in our first visit, we have a detail, you know, what are all the different things that you've tried? So that's what I offer. I also offer an educational session on here's the science of fibromyalgia and long COVID. And why long COVID? So the majority of people that suffer from long COVID, I mean, there's lots of manifestations. I think on the books, there's over 100 different symptoms. But for the most part, the most common symptoms that we hear are fatigue, discognition, so trouble thinking and executive function problems, mood disorders, blood pressure problems. So dysautonomia is a big symptom. And these are all symptoms that people who live with fibromyalgia also contend with. So there's a huge crossover. And at this point in time, we don't have any formal treatment. So it's, again, employing all these same exact assessment skills and evaluation tools. And then I keep up with what's happening with long COVID and what treatments we know. For example, there has been some positive evidence that getting vaccines helps, that taking Paxlovid if you get COVID will help mm-hmm. reduce long COVID. There's some evidence of the microbiome being adjusted with COVID. And the belief is that because of that microbiome having been altered, you're now producing less 5-HT, which is serotonin. So that difficulty thinking and focusing and depression is all related to the fact that you're not making enough 5-HT. So one of the treatments is a probiotic. So again, mm-hmm. going back to nutrition and how important the mm-hmm. nutrition and the microbiome are to your total body wellness. So that's why they're together, because the tools that I use for both of those kinds of patients. And again, these are patients, the people with long COVID that have ended up in offices and people have said, I don't have anything else to do for you. I don't know what to do, you know? And I think that this all fits well in rheumatology, especially long COVID and fibro, because I think we're slowly realizing that post-viral syndromes often turn on autoimmune diseases. And, you know, sometimes it's not immediate, sometimes it's delayed. So I always look for that. And as I said before, all of my patients, I do a screening to make sure we're not missing an autoimmune process. And then I tell my patients that once a year, I'll redo that screening, or once a year or with new symptoms. Yeah. So that we're always keeping in mind that we may not know what you have, but we're still looking.
That's so key. And I, in my case, I did have something called the Coxsackie virus before my diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It was just like a throat blister. It was a couple years before, but I've always wondered if that was like the kind of...
Well, so we're pretty sure that there is a genetic predisposition for, you know, each of the different autoimmune diseases. And then it's that epigenetics that turn it on, right? So whether it was the stress you had in graduate school, plus the fact that you got Coxsackie, plus whatever.
Family history. I have a great aunt with RA. No immediate family, like no parent, you know, parents or siblings, but my grandma's sister had it. And so as a juvenile arthritis, and she lived a long, beautiful life actually, but, which wasn't as common back, you know, back then, because they didn't have any good treatments, but, you know, I think there is a lot of concern in the RA, you know, rheumatoid arthritis community about, am I, you know, what would I, if I start having worse fatigue after I've had COVID, does that mean that it's long COVID? Is it mean that my, but it's like that whack-a-mole. Is it my disease just progressing? Like, my medications aren't working? Or is it that, is it long COVID? It's kind of, at the end of the day, I come back to uncertainty, being able to, the skill of being able to tolerate and cope with uncertainty kind of has to be employed, because at a certain point you can use these diagnostic things we were talking about earlier with, you know, the blood work and try to figure out, okay, this is maybe probably not the RA, this is that. But at a certain point you're going to kind of, I mean, do you agree that you kind of get to a guessing game at a certain point?
I mean, it's always, you want to have an educated guess, right?
Yeah, guess. Yeah.
So for the most part, we can usually get to the bottom of what's going on.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah. I think for the most part, I mean, but that's what rheumatology is, right? Rheumatology is investigative medicine. That's what we love about it. Anybody who's in rheumatology, for the most part, loves the fact that it's, you know, all about the fact that these are patients that have been to three or four other people. Nobody could figure out what was going on. I mean, the chief complaint for most of my patients walking through the door is fatigue and pain. Okay. Now that could be how many different things?
Literally thousands. And then I think that I wrote down as you were talking, I kind of type out stuff that I want to follow up on. But then I was like debating, do I even go into this? Because it's another complicating factor, but it's ME/CFS, like myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome. That one is so tricky, because you really have to, as far as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the post-exertional malaise really complicates the degree to which, or the way that you approach exercise and activity levels.
Right. But it doesn't mean you can't approach exercise and activity. You just have to approach it differently. So
what do you do with those patients? Yeah.
I try to work with a physical therapist and or an occupational therapist that has knowledge of it, because you do have to work with them differently. So for someone who doesn't have ME/CFS, they can push through fatigue. But if you have ME/CFS, you can make it worse, right? You can create symptoms that feel like you have the flu coming on. Doesn't mean that you can't condition. You just have to condition differently, in a slower process and in a slower way. So I think that's the key, is you have to give hope that there is an answer. So I want to tell you a good story. And this happens, I think, more often than I'm aware of. So I saw a patient, I hadn't seen her for 3 years. And I was like, oh my gosh, where have you been? I haven't seen you. And her statement to me was, well, I did everything you told me and I felt much better. I just needed a little reboot.
Oh, reboot. I love it. I love that. Yeah. I mean, that's great. Cause I think, I guess this is my own having, I went to therapy, and I still, you know, go for checkups like every couple months, but for a while I was going weekly to a psychologist and then eventually a psychiatrist, and who does actual therapy, which I didn't know psychiatrists did, by the way, like hour long therapy, you know.
That's pretty awesome if you can find someone that does.
Oh my gosh, he's like, he's so popular now that he doesn't even keep a wait list. Like, I got so lucky to get in with him. But anyway, he's actually an OCD and phobia specialist. So I was having kind of potential, who knows, it's everything's interrelated, but not directly related to my knowledge to the RA. I was starting to get claustrophobia and clitrophobia. which is fear of being trapped. And it, the only way it relates to RA is that when I have had a lot of pain, I had a car accident and a bunch of other stuff that happened to me in the mid 2000s. I started feeling trapped in my body and like having a panic attack. Like I can't get out of my body. Like I feel.
Yeah. I don't like this body. I'm in pain. I don't want to be
in pain. Yeah. I had a lot of pain from my car accident. And then I started fixating on like, what if I get locked in syndrome and like, I can't move when I'm stuck in my body even more. And like, so obviously I needed therapy. So I went to therapy. And one of the things
And you had thoughts that were not working for you.
They were not helpful thoughts. Those were not thoughts. Those thoughts were not facts. Yeah. But it wasn't a CBT. So this is what's interesting about the approach that they use that's really evidence, you know, based for phobias, at least, is it's not about, you can't argue with your thoughts. So the people, they know that today, I know I'm actually like, let's say I'm afraid of spiders. That's an easier example for me to talk about because it's not the one I deal with. It's like, you could tell someone all day long, like get them to say logically, like, well, what are the facts about spiders? Is this spider? This doesn't work because your brain doesn't care about logic right now. So the thing that works is the exposure therapy and having to not just expose yourself to the stimulus, but expose yourself to the sensation physically in your body of your own panic and being able to expose yourself to that sense of uncertainty. So like, how does this all relate to arthritis? Well, or chronic illness or ME/CFS or long COVID is that at a certain point, you give your best educated guess and you get to a treatment plan. But what I have found helpful too has been spending time saying, even if the doctor tells me or the nurse practitioner tells me 99.9% chance this is going to work, there is always a degree of uncertainty to life and learning to tolerate that and say, okay, well, instead of fixating on, well, I don't know for sure. And how do I get that 99% to 100%? Say, okay, well, how can I still proceed and have like a joyful life, you know, meaningful, vibrant life? Cause I can't get stuck all day fixating on this. It's not the life I want to have. So anyway, I think that's what a lot of people get, at least, you know, I know that when I run my Room to Thrive support groups, it's a very much like we balance between, you know, problem solving and solution oriented, you know, self-management. And we also say, let's just take a moment to support each other through the difficulty of this and say, yeah, this sucks. Like, let's not make a mistake about it and try to be like, you know, put a rainbow on top of like a pile of crap. Like it's hard. This is hard. And let's support each other through that, you know? But I think,
well, isn't that what?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'm sorry. Isn't that sort of the whole idea of the spoon theory? Misriana.
I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't either. But you know, it does suck and it is hard to deal with and you only get so much energy to deal with it. And that's why, again, you know, making sure that you organize your life to make sense. So it sucks because you know what, before you had this condition, maybe you didn't need to plan ahead. Maybe you didn't need to be as organized. But now to get through the day, if you're not, it means you flare. And so now you're gonna have to do things differently. And I think the uncertainty is key, but also accepting that life is not the same as it was before. It doesn't mean life can't be beautiful, but it isn't the same. And that goes for whether you have RA, whether you have fibro, whether you have long COVID, whether you have ankylosing spondylitis, and gout put together, you know, whatever crazy combination of diseases you have them now and life is different, but life can still be beautiful. I think that's probably a good note we should leave on.
I was going to say that's so perfect. Well, and I think, that acceptance and commitment therapy is the technique I find that's what my therapist uses. And that's what has been the most helpful for me. And it is evidence-based, you know, for chronic pain and developing that values oriented, what do I value? What's important in my life? How to commit to moving towards that versus making your whole life just about, you know, slaying the dragon of your chronic illness, because it's a delicate.
Right. Cause then that dragon is in charge, right? If that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And you want to lead the dance, not let the pain or the disease lead the dance, right? So there's two other things I just want to do before I leave.
Perfect.
I want to just highlight Dr. Afton Hassett's book. I recommend it to all of my patients. So what she's done in chronic pain reset, CPR for your pain, think of it that way.
Oh,
CPR,
I love that.
Chronic pain reset. So what she's done is she's taken the science on things like acceptance commitment therapy, DBT, CBT, and positive psychology, and she's brought it all together in this one book. Thank you for having it available for us.
Yes.
To look at.
We didn't plan this.
It's like, it is mandatory reading for my patients. Yeah. If I could spoon feed it to them, that's how important I think that book is. And then lastly, I'm going to leave you with the words of the very first rheumatologist I ever worked with. And his name was Mark Bernstein. And he introduced me to what fibromyalgia is. Well, he introduced me to all of what everything in rheumatology is. But in that, he would leave patients with this parting word. He'd say, find the things in life that make you feel good and do more of them. And the things in life that make you feel bad, do less of them.
It's so simple. It just might work. I love it. I love it. Thank you so much. I feel like, and there's so much more we could talk about, but I feel like we covered a lot in one day. So I really appreciate your time. You're like totally a rock star. And I'm going to link everyone. Unfortunately for us, social chronically online people, Dr. Stoas is not super online. That's okay though. Fortunately for you, you're not, because believe me, it can be a little overwhelming.
Time. I'm trying to do too many things. I apologize.
Yes. No, don't apologize. I'm working on boundaries and saying no to things too. So believe me, it's easier to say no to social media if you haven't started it already than it is once you've started it.
I would say is, if anyone ever wants to get in touch, if they want to be seen in our clinic, just go through you and they can, you can communicate with me.
And I don't know why I don't know. Okay. What city are you in? I know you're in New York. Where are
Yes,
you?
I'm on Long Island.
Okay.
And I actually do a lot of my patients virtually, but I have to at least meet you once physically.
Okay.
And then I can't see people in another state.
Oh, so they have to be New York State residents. Okay.
Yeah. Because I don't have a license in another state.
I really hope we're in OT. We're working on an interstate licensure compact. I don't know if they're doing that for NPs too, but
there's been, you know, with the pandemic, there was definitely an effort to do some of that. I have a ton of patients that go to Florida and Pennsylvania. And so it's definitely been an issue, but we don't have a solution to it as yet.
I know everyone in New York who's listening to this is rejoicing at the moment. Like, I want to see her. She's so cool. So thank you so much. And I hope everyone enjoyed this. And please, I'm always trying to remind everyone at the end of the episode that there's going to be a video. If you're listening to this on audio, you know, like Apple Podcasts or whatever, there's also a video if you want to see us gesticulating and a full transcript.
There was a lot of that.
There was a lot. We were hitting our microphones and it was fine. But, there's also a transcript. I provide a transcript of every episode for accessibility. And also I actually like being able to review and look at some of the things we said and like pull out quotes and stuff. And so if that's kind of your learning style more, that's on the Arthritis Life website, which is arthritis.theenthusiasticlife.net. That's the full, I usually just say myarthritislife.net because that redirects to my website, but thank you so much. And maybe we'll do a part two one of these days too. I know you're a busy lady.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Arthritis Life podcast. This episode is brought to you by Room to Thrive, an educational program I created from scratch to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. You can go through the pre-recorded course on your own, or you can take the course along with a support group. Learn more at the link in my show notes, or you can always go to www.myarthritislife.net. And if you like this podcast, I would be so honored if you took the time to rate and review it. I also encourage you to share it with anyone you know who might benefit from it. I also wanted to remind you that you can find full transcripts, videos, and detailed show notes with hyperlinks for each episode on my website, www.myarthritislife.net. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or if you want to share your story or wisdom on the podcast, just shoot me an email at info@myarthritislife.net. I can't wait to hear from you.
Bye.